Good afternoon. I too want to start by thanking Susan, Vika, and Tamsin for the entire conference organizing committee for what is a just absolutely superbly organized and really just beautifully put together conference today. The first panel was, I'm thinking of as like the Jedi Council. It was just a tremendous one, and colleagues on this panel, it's really something. So I'm gonna discuss a project that I'm involved with at Stanford, where I teach. I teach in the history department there. And it was a project that actually was born at roughly the same time as a book that I just completed, The Chinese Typewriter, because they both came out of an earlier, I guess, instantiating question that gave rise to both of them of how things disappear. So I'm interested in non-transitive disappearance, the going away of things, ruination, whether language, whether social, linguistic, whether social, and so forth. And one pathway came out of that sent me in the directions of language technology, and the other one sent me in the direction of the human body and human remains and graves. So there is a connection between these different things, but I won't bother you to go and say any more than that. So this is a project called the Chinese Deathscape, which is a collaborative, born digital, peer-reviewed, soon-to-be published work on Stanford University Press's new Mellon-funded digital initiative. And it brings together historians, predominantly, on a platform that was custom designed through very long collaborative process with David McClure, who is the designer of Neatline. He was briefly at Stanford, where we kind of stole him away, and then he was stolen away to, complete his PhD work at MIT. So he's actually in the neighborhood, but I think he's very, very busy. And what I'm about to show you in the platform, which I can't animate for you, I didn't do a screencast, so I'll have to gesticulate how it works, I'll give you a preview, a very straightforward looking thing. It looks very simple and straightforward, but I'm not a developer myself, but my understanding is that for those of you who do code and program and develop, that when you see something of a certain elegance, you realize just how much more work went into it. And I can't take credit for any of that work except the collaborative multi-year process of helping with it. I really want to make sure to credit David McClure for that. The central question that sparked all of this maybe 10 years ago was a cab ride from the airport at Dunhuang in northwest China to the hotel where I was staying, and I looked out one side of the window of the cab, and I saw these markers out in the distance, and I simply asked the driver, "What are those?" And he said, "Those are graves. Those are grave markers." And then a little bit of time went by, and there was silence in the car, and then he said, "Oh, and they used to be over there," and he pointed out the other side of the car, on the other side of the highway. And it made me, I don't know, I think it evoked a lot of questions about the persistence of human remains after life. It brought back childhood memories of growing up in this subdivision in Maryland, and I was climbing around in the woods like I would every chance I got, and coming across a gravestone that was the burial site of Francis Scott Key's grandmother, just in this tucked away in these woods and kind of out of the way. And I've always really been obsessed of just how things that used to be understood as persistent and everlasting, and things and people we've always imagined would just be with us forever, aren't extinguished. They're not eradicated. These aren't books that are burned. These aren't acts of genocide that I'm talking about. I'm just talking about the sort of slow, crushing, and expected entropy and ruination of existence, whereby the subdivision surrounds Francis Scott Key's grandmother, and suddenly she's in the middle of the woods and she's being found by a suburban kid. And how does that process take place? Well, I got back to my hotel, and then I thought about it, and I kept going, and I began to look into the question of the relocation of graves in China. How prevalent was this? I mean, of course, we know about major events of this and minor events of this, but how prevalent was this? Within maybe an hour of very basic search, I had uncovered one site of 15,000 graves relocated, 100,000 graves relocated, 5,000, another 80,000, another, and just suddenly I began to try to get a mental map in my mind. And I was already reaching numbers like 5 million, 7 million, 10 million corpses being relocated in the span of maybe 10 years. So we're talking about the great, you know, catacombs of Paris, except on a much, much larger scale in a much smaller period of time. And I began to worry about this in a sense, in that it kept staying with me, even though I worked on other books and other projects. And so this is where this comes from, this war between the living and the dead. Just to give you, for those of you who don't read Chinese, this is an amazing sort of political cartoon, which has this young mother and her child on a park bench. And under here you see 有限的土地, this is limited land. And then you see these three skeletons, and on their skulls, the characters for land burial. And they have an ID card that one skeleton is showing up, a shenfenzheng. And then you see at the bottom right, the dead are crowding out the living. And I realized as an historian of China, but now moving and not moving, but just now fascinated by a radically contemporary period. We're talking about an intense period of time in the last 10 years of a concern with a radically contemporary, that this was, in essence, the mirror image of the much more well-known birthing policy and of one-child policy. So the one-child policy in its darkest forms of forced sterilization or forced abortion, but more of an actual, one of the most controversial and well-known policies in the, not the Maoist period, but the post-Maoist period in China, and that this was the mirror image. If that was a concern with the overpopulation of the living, this paroxysm of activity in the past 10 years was this deep concern with the overpopulation of the dead. And a movement which is happening now still is a kind of commitment at a nationwide level, at a policy level, to become a hyper-alive state, much like Singapore has already achieved in a much, much smaller scale, and some other territories on Earth have achieved on much smaller scales, but of course as one of the two most populous countries on Earth. So there are some moments in this. I want to explain why it was that this took me into digital realms. I'm an archival historian by training, but I work constantly and fluidly between search and online databases, and then I find phone numbers of people and I cold call them and I ask, are you the great nephew of so-and-so? And yes, and then it constantly cycles back and forth between the analog and the digital. But it's qualitative. I've never done sort of large corpus. I've never tried to map an entire phenomenon. But in this context, it became very clear that my brain simply had no fighting chance of coming up with any insight, any instinct or hunch about this phenomenon, because I just couldn't get my mind around it. What does it even mean to say that in 15 years, somewhere in the order of 10 to 15 million bodies have been just moved around the surface of the Earth? What does that even mean? I guess I could just choose one town or one province, but that's not actually what I'm after, and that's not somehow what's gonna get me, I think, at my problematic. And I could have done that. There are very famous examples within this controversial grave relocation campaign in China. One of the most provocative, contentious, episode happened in Henan province in a town, city, and greater region of Zhoukou. In Zhoukou, in the span of 8 months, roughly 8 months, 2.5 million bodies were moved. It was this mass effort, and you would see images like this of whole teams going out into the countryside with backhoes, destroying grave monuments, digging up graves, relocating them. And all of these were for things that you might expect. The mechanization of agriculture so that we could bring large-scale threshers into these areas, and the grave mounds were in the way, the building of airports, the building of schools, and so forth. And this could have been just enough. And then there were smaller-scale issues. smaller scale stories that surface to the level of news, of where one grave, the relocation of one individual's remains, made it all the way to centrally broadcasted news. This was a famous case in which the party that was going to undertake relocation had basically violated one of the laws that governed this policy, which is that prior to relocation, you have to advertise in the local newspaper that this is going to happen, so that the family has some time to come and claim, get a very, very small stipend that doesn't cover the cost of it, but still then undergo the process, hire a feng shui master to tell what day they might want to move and all these things. Well, this person, we don't know who it was, I guess, just simply printed out this notice, or maybe wrote it out by hand. We're going to move such and such graves by like this date, printed it out, stuck it on the grave itself, and put a rock on it. And this was a huge issue, of course, because there's a very likelihood chance that the family would never know that the body of a loved one would be moved without their knowledge. And this happened all the time. People would come during grave sweeping day, the annual celebration of one's ancestors and of the dead, where you go to the grave, you clean it, you burn ritual paper money to transmit it to the afterlife, and they would discover that their family member was gone, because they didn't see the notice in the newspaper, they worked in another town. So any one of these would have been fine. There's contentious issues, there's cartoons that surround it. Anyone that came of age during the Cultural Revolution of a certain age would, seeing this image, have instantly thought of a Mao-era campaign of destroying the four olds. In this case, it wasn't about radical kind of leftist progressive movements of the destruction of the four olds. This was a grave monument in Henan. But this was no good. There's one example which I love, which is a video campaign, which is a Gangnam style video by these kids that went viral, in which they made this video said Wopa Pingfen style. It was like I fear grave flattening style, and they painted their face. And so there's enough out there, I guess, for someone in with my training to do, I guess, what I would consider to be an injustice, a quick take to the material. I prefer to spend about 10 years on a book if I can. And so instead, I wanted to try to get the full scale at all possible with all available evidence that I could get my hands on to try to get the entirety, of course not entirety, but the entirety of available evidence in one place, in one platform. And so over the course of 5 years now, no, 6 years now, we created the first database, I guess, of grave relocations in contemporary China. Their dates, their scales when known, the actual individual parties that were responsible for it, the reasons that were for it. And this is actually a preview of the platform, so let me talk about that for a second, and then let's talk about how it's built and how it's published. I think I'll focus on those two issues today. So it looks just kind of like a straightforward issue. You've got a textual essay along the side. This one's a draft by myself. And then you have a front-end platform that has base layer possibilities, different demographic layers being pulled out of the Michigan China Data Center. You can overlay selectively various imported historic maps if you want to, georectified maps, if you want to compare relocation efforts against, I don't know, a 1920s map of Shanghai to see which of these cemeteries might this be. But the important thing, and this is what I can't show dynamically, is that there is an incredibly straightforward and elegant relationship whereby these basic hyperlinks that are on the left side, which you can just encode with very basic markup language on the back end, linked to a particular place on the map, can bring you to a particular zoom level on the map, can turn on or off various base layers and demographic layers on the fly, can demarcate a certain temporal span and then turn them off. And in essence, it's an essay in which you are never not in space. You are never not somewhere on the map. And so it's moving away from a framework of 2,000 words, inset map, try to remember what we were talking about, let me tell you what this map says, moving on. is that you are constantly moving through. And the editorial process, which I'll talk about a little bit at the end, is a really fascinating one and really challenging because it's almost cinematic. It's almost cinematography. For every one of these links, thinking through the argumentative framework of that paragraph at that place, we have to ask questions. What is the most revealing zoom level? What do we want to turn on and off at this in this scene? Of course, it's not a video. You can stop it at any moment. But it's inspired all of these editorial decisions that we didn't realize we were going to have to even think about until we actually sat down and started to get the essays coming in. And the goal of the platform was elegance, simplicity, and a framework where you could very rapidly move across scale. You could move out to this impossibly large, span, surfacing all the data points all at once. But you could also then, depending on the narrative, move very, very close into space and try to work through the story of one month in one town involving one individual or one family, but never make that final compromise to say, no, I'm just going to do a local history of this phenomenon, or I'm going to do a sort of political economy of this problem, either one of them, which entails obvious problems and differences. So the way this was, this is the landing page, and then you kind of go down, and then you move through this. And this is one of the historic maps. These are test subjects, really. And you begin to move through this as you go. Now, the way that this was built, I want to emphasize the way it was built and the difficulty of publishing it, because this is all that labor we keep talking about, but that never shows up in the final product. It's the, most of this was 5 years of just entering and cleaning data, and then the most recent 2 years, these overlap, have been just all of these puzzles and challenges involved with peer-reviewed digital publishing that not even Stanford University Press had anticipated at the outset, and one of them is really important. But in any event, this is the raw material of the database. These are those kind of classified ad-sized grave relocation notifications, these qianfen tong qishi or qianfen gonggao, and these are just basically very small advertisements in many, many, many different local newspapers saying, all of the graves west of Apple Orchard Road, north of the preschool, south of the such and such reservoir and east of this road, all of the graves in that territory are going to be relocated by April 15th, 2009. Here's a phone number, call. Anyone that doesn't call, a grave will be considered untended and just handled by the state. And talking about the sort of constant interflow between the digital and the kind of qualitative analog methods, the only way that I was able to get at these is because of digitized newspaper collections. It would have cost probably in the millions of dollars to be able to go to every county level library in China to find these newspapers, not to mention all the time of perusing through them. I could plug in a certain terminology that would get me right to where I'm going. But still, it took about 3 years just to move through this stuff and get it into a workable format, and that basically supplies the back end. Another important point about this, and I think this will resonate with many in the audience, is the fundamentally incomplete, inconsistent, and variable form of humanistic data in this case. I remember having, prior to working with David McClure, I worked with another person, we kind of had a different working relationship with each other, let's say, and it was this sort of question of, what do you want me to build? I don't know what I want you to build. This is an exploratory mode for me because I don't have the problematic in my mind. I need help to even arrive at the hunch of a problematic. And it's like, well, I can't build you that. Not in so many terms, but it was this kind of, and where's your data set? Well, half of the cells are filled, half of them are not. And I'm sorry, but they never will be even. It will always be uneven. Some of these grave relocations, we know how many remains were moved. Some we do not know because they have to be corroborated with other data sources. Some places we know the location all the way down to the village level, so depth unevenness, and some of them we can attribute them to the centroid of a county level, polygon that has a population of 200,000 people. So this unevenness how do we deal with this? Not be afraid of it, but also surface it. And so we had to come up with a kind of visual symbology that would allow us to do that. But There are a few insights that instantly showed up. This is a CardoDB early representation, not the actual platform. But there are these moments, actually this one is probably even clearer, of stories that emerge at meso, local, and these sort of macro levels. Here, and this is one story which I think is clear enough within a context like this I can get it across. Where the base layers are turned on indicate population density. And so you see the darker green is a more population dense, less population dense two regions. And those purple circles are grave relocation events. A grave relocation event could be one grave or it could be 200,000 graves. It depends on scale, and we tried with diameter to indicate scale. Later on, we created another kind of diameter which indicated unknown at this point. But in any event, what you see here is this band of nearly simultaneous grave relocations pretty much right at the border of this higher and lower population density thing. The city is about to erupt. It's about to move out in a particular direction into the peri-urban region, and it's not doing this universally in all directions. It's happening in certain ways. The other one I showed you, it's a little bit harder to see, but there's a lighter green, lower population density on the north side of this river, heavier, more dense. This city of Changzhou is about to jump over the river, just like Shanghai did a few decades ago, just like many. So you can, someone joked that I should have sold this to a real estate developer or something like that, because they would have known. I said, I'm glad that I didn't, because my wife and I are searching for a house and we don't like real estate developers right now. Anyway, so I'll close with, this is one of the most amazing, the other thing this platform allows you to do, you can pull in any manner of multimedia, videos, still images in the classic sense of HTML markup. This is a nail grave. This is someone who was told to relocate, but who refused and held out as the world was literally being dug out around them. And it's really just a negotiation standpoint at a certain point. His family managed to get a much higher stipend from the government to finally get away. It's a little bit like the movie Up by Pixar in this sense. I just want to close by talking about, I'll leave this title up here while I talk about this part of it, if there's a whole world of labor and production that we don't talk about, well, we talk about it, but we don't tend to talk about it at these conferences. I have never seen a panel at a DH-ish related conference that says, here is what my student interns did, and like, what are your students? It's sort of this quiet labor that we tacitly acknowledge and then we do, but without which it would be impossible to get these things done. There's this other thing that's emerging now, which I think many in the room will be much more experienced at than I, and this is new, emergent, inconsistent, incomplete modes of publishing that are connected with born digital projects, and I want to emphasize peer-reviewed born digital publishing. So I'm not talking about the platforms or user experience or navigability. I mean this very old and I think well trod and a phenomenon I support, obviously, of peer-reviewed scholarship brought into a digital frame, which I'm a big, big supporter of. I think that was the key in many ways to rendering this type of scholarship, especially for younger colleagues, render it legible to tenure committees and to job committees. It's like, oh, this was rigorously reviewed and peer-reviewed in a way that I understand. Okay, I don't quite understand all of these other methods you're talking about. It's a little bit strange for me to see this in this platform, but to know this at least brings it into a regime that I understand. Well, something very funny happens when you bring collaborative humanities developer RA world together with peer review. And it's very simple. You have the platform, you send it out for review. This platform, which is slated for this coming year on SUP, sent out to 7 reviewers. Basically a 4-3 split between China expertise and platform expertise. And you get the reader reports in the classic way that we all know, and they recommend certain things. And it became very clear, though, on the China side, why haven't you attended to questions of diversity in the South? Okay, yes, that's a very, very good point, or whatever. Maybe you should write this. No, we're not going to do that, because that's a different volume. But then on the developer side is, I think you should build in a time slider.
Or there should be a, are you going to embed some kind of citability in this with a link that would allow you not only to capture, you know, the essay, but to capture a particular map state at a particular zoom level with a particular set of base layers up. And so you do the same thing as you always do. You read through these, you triage, you commit. But the commitment entails something very different. If I'm told I need, in order to get an article or a book published, I need to rethink X or Y, or get on a plane and go back to the archives, I just eat that labor. It's a very bad labor politics, but I just eat it. I don't say, well, you know, that's going to take me 100 hours, my going rate is, so yes, such and such press, you'll have to pay me this many thousands of dollars and I'll do what you're asking me to do. That sounds absurd to us. Well, if you want a time slider, if you want this citability, I can't build that. And in most collaborative efforts, there's multi-parts of the team that can't do these things, and therefore they can't just simply cheapen their own labor to zero. And so I have to turn to my colleagues and say, do you have, or do you know, someone that can help me build this? And they do say, that's $40,000. Going developer of this skill set is $40,000. And we write back to the press and say, we will do these things. Oh, and by the way, our funding is gone. We have nothing left for this, so this sounds wonderful. I don't know how. And this was a moment. This was a moment in the publication life of this, and I think it's going to be a major public issue in peer-reviewed born digital publication in the future, that funding agencies, when they apply for these Mellon grants, are going to need to keep a pocket of cash for the very possibility of paying their editors or maybe their authors to do the revisions that they want at a platform level. Because fortunately, my colleagues who really do develop don't cheapen their labor the way that we do in the humanities. They actually value their labor. So that's what I want to close on. There's this, you know, but I look forward to questions and I look forward to the discussion with the panel. Thank you.